From Altoona to Westchester, Port Allegheny to Saxonburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, several proposed constitutional amendments are on the fast track for legislative approval to be placed on the May primary ballot. David Taylor is joined by Rebecca Euler and Matthew Briette for a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion. And Pennsylvania's statewide judiciary has been tainted by scandal and political activism. On my town hall commentary, I'll explain why voters this year can begin the process of restoring integrity to the courts. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. President Joe Biden has selected Pennsylvania's controversial health secretary, Dr. Rachel Levine, to be the new U.S. Assistant Health Secretary. A pediatrician, Levine's tenure at the helm of the Commonwealth's Health Department has been tumultuous, as her questionable policies during the COVID-19 pandemic resulted in legislative calls for her removal. Levine has drawn fire for allowing COVID-19 positive patients back into nursing homes, which were then ravaged by the disease. Levine has also implemented some of the harshest shutdown and restriction policies in the nation, triggering a wave of business failures and a spike in the unemployment rate. Levine's new position will require confirmation by the U.S. Senate. More sad news to report from the state capitol. State Senator Dave Arnold of Lebanon County passed away last week at the age of 49 after battling brain cancer. Arnold won a special election to fill the Senate seat just over a year ago. The seat had become vacant due to the resignation of former State Senator Michael Fulmer in the wake of child pornography charges. Arnold had served as Lebanon County's district attorney prior to running for the Senate. Arnold's death comes just weeks after State Representative Mike Reese of Westmoreland County died following a brain aneurysm. A special election to fill Reese's seat will be held in conjunction with the upcoming May primary election. Pennsylvania's statewide constitutional or row officers took the oath of office this past week. Attorney General Josh Shapiro was sworn in for a second term, but there are new occupants in the other two offices. Republican Tim DeFore is Pennsylvania's new Auditor General, replacing former Democratic Auditor General Eugene DePasquale, who was term limited. And Stacey Garrity became the new state treasurer after having defeated Democratic incumbent Joe Torsella in an upset last November. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. As it should be, amending the state constitution is rare. But this year, voters will likely have the opportunity to ensconce in the Constitution a new provision giving the legislature the clear power to rein in a governor's excessive use of emergency powers. Our Capitol Watch crew is here to discuss the process and the reasons behind the drive to amend the state constitution. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the National Federation of Independent Business and by Matthew Briette from Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Rebecca Euler, Legislative Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Rebecca, great to see you.
Good to see you too, Dave. Nice to be here.
Great to be with you. My main man, Matt Briette, CEO of Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. Matt, thanks for being on the show.
Good to be with both of you.
Well, we're a little deeper into 2021, and we've got a new presidential administration in Washington, but we're focused on what's happening with your state government in Sin City, Harrisburg, PA. And, after the travails—
Officially named?
It's an unofficial nickname, but it fits. So after the travails of 2020 and the dictatorial actions of Governor Wolf and the Wolf administration, the power grab rulings, the corrupt rulings of the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, that an effort is being launched to rebalance the scales by doing the steep climb of trying to amend Pennsylvania's state constitution. And then there are a couple of things that are moving here, and we're just going to sort of, you know, line them up, knock them down, let the listeners know what's happening. And so the first one is a perennial. It's a long sought goal for people who believe in limited government, which is a Taxpayer Protection Act. So, Matt, do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, the Taxpayer Protection Act is something that, like you said, David, fiscal conservatives have long wanted to implement a higher standard for excessive spending. And the idea behind this is that government shouldn't outspend the taxpayer's ability
yes.
to pay. You could pick a number of different standards that you could say, all right, here's the limitation we want to put on spending growth. And so an example is in Colorado. They had the Taxpayer Bill of Rights that mm-hmm. were passed, you know, a couple decades ago. And that is what Pennsylvania is modeling it after. It's saying, look, we want to limit the annual growth in government spending to inflation plus population growth. So let's say you had 1% inflation last year and your population growth was 1% as well. You would allow for an increase in spending of 2%. Now, there are other ways you can overcome that. It would be a 2/3 vote of the legislature to say, no, we want to grow it by 2.5 or by 20%, whatever it might be. So there is a way around that, but it sets a higher bar to get over in order for the spending to exceed what would generally be an index of saying, here's our ability to pay.
Right, because Rebecca, in the business world, this is something that we've sought for a long time, that, you know, we want Pennsylvania to be in a virtuous cycle where the economy is growing, and as a result of that organic growth, it's generating additional revenues for the state to meet important public needs, and that having it the reverse, where government grows fast in the private sector, it stifles growth, and it makes it impossible for us to right size state government and especially to prioritize tax relief.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been proven that controlling state spending really does act as an encouragement for the private sector. We know that. And what I really like about the Taxpayer Protection Act is what it does is it forces the policymakers to set priorities and to make trade-offs, just like a business does when it's planning for the year, or just like you do in your home. You have to consider, what are my priorities this year? What are the things I really need to invest in? And then make trade-offs to make it work. And this forces the government to do that, which is just a responsible way to govern and a responsible way to keep spending under control and taxes under control, too.
Basically, every year they come back, they say, well, here's how much we spent last year. Mm-hmm. Here's what we increased demands on various program, so we need X plus whatever percentage every year, and that has gotten us into trouble. Whereas if you said, look, you can spend an additional 2% with a simple majority vote, but if you're going to want to get over and above that limitation, you're gonna have to make a good case for it. So if you prioritize your spending, saying, look, here are the things that we have to pay for, here are the things we would we would like to pay for, and then you start prioritizing, saying, all right, are we willing to go for a tax increase mm-hmm. To pay for these things that are, fall down the line, that, the 25th item on our list of priorities. And that's an important function that government needs to go through.
Exactly. And hopefully it would also change that mindset. And as a result, that the office holders and the people who are running government, that they would work harder at getting more value out of dollars already being spent. And that's something else that we don't have enough of in government. That usually it's just how much we want to spend, and then you go cobble together the revenues to pay for that much spending. And ultimately, this is what has caused, really very directly caused, Pennsylvania's chronic economic underperformance over the years and across the decade. Pennsylvania only ever grows at a fraction of the national average. And that compounds itself over time.
Yes.
And that's what leads to things like declining population, or at least population growth that is not nearly as robust as other places, and that we lose representation in Congress, so on and so forth.
David, I think it is important maybe we back up a little bit and tell people how we amend our state constitution.
Yes, please.
Because I think, where is this in the process? The Taxpayer Protection Act is really at the first stage. And when we get to the other two proposed constitutional amendments, they're a bit further down the track. So the one thing about constitutional amendment is that the governor has nothing to do with this. So this is purely a legislative action, as well as a Democratic vote, because the people of Pennsylvania ultimately have the say on changes to our Constitution. So in order for a constitutional amendment to be put before the people of Pennsylvania, it must pass in the same exact form in two consecutive legislative sessions. And Pennsylvania has a two-year legislative session. We just finished one, 2019 and 2020. We've just started a new one in 21 and 22.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Taxpayer Protection Act has not passed both the House and the Senate before yet. So it will need to pass both bodies in the 21-22 session, and then again in the 23-24 legislative session.
And then after, if it passes in the exact same form in two consecutive sessions of the legislature, then what happens?
And then it goes on to the ballot for an up or down vote. And we've had this before. I think the last one that we had was increasing the age for judges from 70 to 75. They're not often,
mm-hmm.
Because it is a high hurdle.
Yes.
It is passing both the House and the Senate in two consecutive legislative sessions. And so then it goes to the ballot. The ones that have passed, it's been very, very thin margins of late. We're talking 51-49%. So there's no guarantee that these things would pass.
Right. But again, this is how, this is how these ideas, come to be presented to the citizenry.
And this is where the first step was, these have made it through committee,
mm-hmm.
Expecting them to come to the full floor of the House. Then the Senate would consider them. And then the Taxpayer Protection Act would be put aside.
Right.
Until the next legislative session, and then brought up again. And maybe that's where, we have some that two amendments that passed last legislative session
that are viable
and are now being
for this
considered,
time around.
Yes, and did make it out of those same committees.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from NFIB Pennsylvania and Matt Briette from Commonwealth Partners. So we're talking about pending constitutional amendments, or at least proposed constitutional amendments that are under discussion, that are advancing through the legislative process. And, as Matt mentioned, that there are two potential amendments that passed in the previous legislative session, which means if passed, they would then go on to the ballot for the voters. And I know that one of them is the idea of reforming the governor's emergency declaration powers.
The Pennsylvania governor has a 90-day emergency declaration power in which he can act unilaterally without any legislative input. That is one of the longest times that we can see in the country.
Right.
And renewals do not require legislative approval. Many states involve the legislature in continuing such resolutions. They give a governor the ability to respond immediately to a crisis, right? Instead of saying, oh, well, I have to pull in the House and the Senate. No, a governor should have that immediate opportunity to respond to a crisis. But what's happened in Pennsylvania, as we've seen, not only has the governor enjoyed 90 days without legislative input and continuing to do so, the ability or the power of the legislature to rescind those emergency declarations have been thwarted by a hyper-partisan Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So,
which, by the way, is ruling against the black and white letter of the law.
That's correct. I mean, because it was very clear that the legislature said when they passed this emergency declaration power that they could rescind it by a resolution. The Supreme Court somehow manufactured, extraneous language that said, well, the governor can veto that, effectively saying it is a higher hurdle to rescind an emergency declaration than to impeach the governor.
Right, and remove him from office.
And remove him from office.
So it's crazy stuff. And so this is what has made a constitutional amendment necessary.
And that, of course, is in fact exactly what happened last year.
So we're taking it to the next level.
Yeah. Right. So here we are discussing, how to reset the balance of power between the executive and the legislature when it comes to disaster declarations. And this particular amendment actually sort of has three parts to it. One is to allow the legislature to terminate that disaster declaration, just as we talked about. But it also limits the governor's disaster declarations to 21 days unless he gets a legislative approval. For an extension, exactly. It also allows the General Assembly to actually regulate the different types of disasters that might occur, including natural disasters, a military disaster, or a public health disaster. And there's another part of that particular amendment, which is an amendment that ensures equality of rights for race and ethnicity in the state, which I don't think anyone disagrees is a good amendment. So there are sort of four parts to that one amendment, that one bill. It's actually three separate amendments. But that could be considered by the General Assembly as early as the next couple of weeks by the full House, like Matt said, and that would go to the Senate then. If it passes both houses of the General Assembly by February 17th, it could potentially be on the May 18th ballot.
Wow.
So there's a potential that could happen.
Well, certainly the governors and his people have gotten very accustomed to their emergency powers, and they don't like the idea of this amendment at all.
No, they don't. Governor Wolf, for kind of a bit more context to this of how bad or extraordinary these powers are for the governor, there is a Maine Policy Institute analysis called they call it their Balance of Power Index, and Pennsylvania was rated the sixth worst in the nation in terms of these extraordinary powers. And we've seen it where, Pennsylvania's had the second most restricted state in the nation, only after California, according to Wallet Hub. There are a number of indices showing that this is extraordinary power that, unfortunately, has really hindered our economic recovery. And you're absolutely right, David. Governor Wolf does not like this at all. Some of his comments when these passed out of committee he said, House Bill 55, which is the emergency declaration constitutional amendment, he said that would hinder our ability to respond quickly. Now, I'm not sure where he sees 21 days of inability to respond quickly to an impending disaster. And certainly he would get extensions by a legislature if that, crisis
was reasonable.
That's right, if it was reasonable.
And we've proven last year that the General Assembly can meet in extraordinary circumstances,
right,
and even remotely. So I agree, there's no need for more than 21 days to be quick.
That's right. And I think, the irony or, sadness is that he furthered, his push against this amendment. He said it could slow down or halt emergency response when aid is most needed. I don't know if he's, how'd that work for the nursing homes? He's making arguments that fly in the face. He had complete unilateral control, yet the overwhelming majority of deaths in Pennsylvania from COVID occurred in places where the governor had complete 100% oversight and utterly failed to protect the most vulnerable amongst us. So, this is where the governor's desire for power is unbelievable. In fact, part of his response was that he said, really allowing the Constitution to be changed this way, we really should rethink, he said, the very way we amend it, because he says this flies in the face of democracy. That the people should have input. Apparently, the governor doesn't fully understand how a constitutional amendment happens.
Correct. The people's elected representatives in the General Assembly put a resolution on the ballot for the consideration of the voters who then vote up or down. Sounds pretty representative and democratic to me. So this did pass the previous session. It may be acted upon in time for the May primary ballot, which means the voters could be facing it very, very soon, which, of course, is an important change for Pennsylvania. The third and final constitutional amendment that's being considered would be changing the way that we elect our statewide courts, and that it would move – the proposal would be to move away from statewide elections across all 67 counties, and instead to have specific judicial districts, the way that the federal courts in Pennsylvania are either in the Western District, the Middle District, or the Eastern District, that we would have specific, you know, geographic areas from which these jurists would be elected, and that this way we would have more geographic balance and representation of the entire Commonwealth, as opposed to the current configuration whereby the people who sit on the courts are for the most part from the big urban centers.
Yeah, this is the idea being that we would have a broader representation across the state as opposed to really the corners having the overwhelming majority on our three statewide courts. So we have a Supreme Court that has seven members on it. I believe four are from Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. One from Philly, and two from different parts of the state or the center parts of the state. Then you've got 15 members of the Superior Court. I don't know the breakdown there, but again, a massive representation from the Philadelphia
and
Allegheny
counties.
Historically,
that's always been so.
Okay, you're correct. And then you've got nine members of the Commonwealth Court as well. And the idea behind this is that we would divide up the state in districts. You'd have seven districts for Supreme Court, 15 for Superior Court, and nine for Commonwealth Court. And the idea being, well, we would get broader representation from all across the state on all three of these statewide Supreme and appellate courts.
Yeah. So this is something that passed the previous session. And so, again, this is a live issue for the current session of the General Assembly just begun. So anyway, interesting stuff. As always, the listeners know that representative self-government is not a spectator sport. You got to choose to be informed and choose to be involved. So we do our part to try to help you with doing that. But that's all the time that we have for this week's program. Matt, where can people go to learn more about you and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, go to thecommonwealthpartners.com or at Facebook, facebook.com/Commonwealth Partners.
And Rebecca, where can the listeners find you?
We're at nfib.com/PA or on Facebook or Twitter.
And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. So from Matt and Rebecca and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Pennsylvanians will not be voting for president or electing a governor or U.S. senator this year. But there are five statewide offices that recent events prove are every bit as important and perhaps have an even bigger impact on our daily lives as those higher-profile offices. This being an odd-numbered year, the focus will be on the judicial branch of government. Voters statewide will be electing a state Supreme Court justice, two judges of the Commonwealth Court, and a judge on the state Superior Court. In past years, aside from vested special interests and political insiders, very little attention has been paid to these races. The result, especially with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, has been an activist judicial branch more given to legislating than adjudicating. First, a civics lesson. The judiciary in Pennsylvania begins at the local level with magisterial district judges who handle minor cases such as traffic tickets and sometimes determine whether there is enough evidence for a person charged with a crime to be bound over to common pleas court. The county courts of common pleas are the next tier in the judicial structure and the level which is the most visible and where most cases are handled. The next step up the judicial ladder is the statewide appellate courts, which include Commonwealth and Superior Court. Those intermediate appellate courts, simply put, handle civil and criminal appeals from the courts of common pleas, along with some regulatory issues. Atop the judicial pyramid sits the state Supreme Court. That court accepts very few cases for review, raising the importance of the Commonwealth and Superior Courts as the venues of last resort. Thus, cases heard by the state Supreme Court are those of the most significant legal and constitutional importance. Now, there was a time when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was an esteemed bench of jurists of highest repute. That is no longer the case. In the early to middle years of the last decade, a number of justices were forced to resign from that bench for various misdeeds, including sending or receiving emails containing pornography. Amid that disgrace, organized labor poured millions into low-profile races to replace the offending justices, successfully ensconcing three highly political judicial activists on the bench. The election of 2015 also marked the end of the Republican majority on the high court as Democrats seized a 5-2 advantage. Thus were planted the seeds of the court's run of politically tinged decisions. In 2018, the new Democrat majority fulfilled a campaign promise by declaring the state's congressional redistricting plan to be unconstitutional. Despite clear constitutional language giving the legislature the power to draw those lines, the court instead appointed a left-wing college professor from California to draw a new map, which they then imposed by judicial fiat. As state lawmakers struggled to end Governor Tom Wolf's emergency powers related to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Supreme Court again effectively rewrote state law by ruling that plain language giving the legislature the sole power to end such declarations didn't mean what it said. Instead, the court ruled the governor has the power to sign or veto such a resolution, thus allowing his draconian policies to remain in effect. Voters likely will have the last say in that matter, as a proposed constitutional amendment giving the legislature the clear authority to regulate such emergency declarations will be on the May primary ballot for approval. Last year, the Supreme Court so effectively rewrote state election law that one lawmaker half-jokingly suggested the justices be named legislators of the year. In clear contravention of the law, the justices allowed the counting of ballots for up to 3 days after the general election, invalidated signature requirements, and struck the Green Party's presidential candidates from the ballot, all to bolster Democratic efforts to win the state for Joe Biden, which he did. And so, Pennsylvanians have witnessed a decade of corruption and political activism by our Supreme Court. The one seat up for election this year is one of the two held by Republicans, so it won't tilt the balance on the court. But it is vitally important that we begin the process of cleansing the state's appellate courts of judicial activists and replacing them with constitutionalists who will restore integrity and balance to the judicial branch. Voters will have that opportunity this year. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 26 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WEDOAM in White Oak, along with WAEBAM and WKAPAM in Whitehall, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville. All of them have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.